This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have former Port Townsend resident of many years, Mary Lou Cinelli, who has earned a solid reputation in the literary and public speaking community through a steady commitment to writing and through 20 years of successful public readings and presentations. She has published 7 collections of poetry and 3 works of nonfiction, Among Friends, Falling Awake, and her newest title, A Woman Writing. In Seattle now, her regular columns appear in Seattle City Living Magazine, Art Access Magazine, and she has written for the Seattle Times, Seattle Metropolitan Magazine, Morning Edition, National Public Radio, Seattle's NPR affiliate station, KUOW-FM, and many other publications and radio stations. Mary Lou presents her work at corporate events, women's conferences, literary venues, colleges and universities, book clubs, private events, and fundraising salons. What Cinelli does in front of an audience is easier to recognize than it is to define, says the Seattle Times. And I would agree, because here in Port Townsend, we were treated to a reading by Mary Lou at Northwind Arts Center just a few months ago. Many of us know Mary Lou from her dance performances as well, and her teaching of lyrical style contemporary dance, which she now teaches in workshops worldwide. In fact, she's here today because she's teaching in our area. Her website, if you'd like to learn more about Mary Lou's current events, is www.marylousinelli.com, and I will spell that for you, MarylouSanelli. And I want to welcome Mary Lou.
Hi, thank you, Sheila. It's good to be here.
I'm glad you're here, and I know you do go back and forth quite a bit and love getting away from the city and the travel and hanging out in our, what you call...
You know, I really feel like Port Townsend's still my emotional home. I just professionally need to be in the city. I know that sounds sort of strange, but it's just that my life, I work as a literary speaker, and that work did not exist how I imagined it would exist. So I spend a lot of effort making it exist and have over the last 10 years. And what that leads to is just being available to speak at conferences that come through the convention center. Let's say there I'm booked at one, but let's say also there is a cancellation, which there is a lot. I'm right downtown in Belltown. I can be there in a half hour. I've sort of developed this reputation of being available and with a talk to go because I developed 6 different talks that I can give. So no matter what group is there, there's one we can pick.
I was going to ask you questions about developing your career in a less populated small town area and then moving out to a bigger place with more possibilities for the work you do. And the reason I was going to ask you is that Port Townsend is so well noted as a place that writers come more mid-career to late career after they've had the experience you're having now in Seattle, and then they want to lay back and have quiet, and you've kind of done the reverse. So let us know how it
was
to start here.
That's true, except that a lot of people don't realize that I grew up in a city, New York City. Then when I went to college, it was slower, but I think the main thing for me was wanting to be paid for my work. And I sensed a place that I could make this career happen. And that's difficult to make happen, both as a choreographer, dancer, or as a literary speaker in a small town. It winds up costing you versus being paid to do the work. That's really the bottom line.
Uh-huh.
I need to make a living.
Wow, how unusual.
You know, as an artist in Port Townsend, it's all so beautiful and wonderful, and it is quiet, but it's volunteer.
Well, here we are at our volunteer radio station.
Which is wonderful. Community radio is everything, you know, because so much of other radio stations, and I do them, every radio station is starting to sound like every other radio station with the programs they buy and everything. So when community radio is still vital, that is something worth hanging on to for a community in every way. So thank you.
And thank you for being here again. So you call yourself a literary speaker.
Yes.
And that is an interesting term.
Isn't it?
And it is one that you came across when you wanted to create the career, or you created it along with
literary
the career?
Literary speaker. You know, I think that I started using the term because when people hire me, I'm not one of those speakers, and I'm in the green room with them all the time. They move back and forth. Their whole talk is pretty much choreographed, and it's more of a motivational speaking sort of thing. I wanted no part of that. I wanted to read from my work and speak about my work and go from one to the other. And I found that even at tech conferences, which I've been a guest at, by the end of the 3 days or whatever, they want somebody. I created a niche for myself. They want somebody who's actually hands-on doing their life. And honestly, Sheila, everyone wants to be a writer.
Right.
So I don't care if you're a coder in Silicon Valley, your dream is to be a writer. So that's created a niche for me where I can go and speak from my books about the process of writing. So yeah, that's what I've created, literary speaker.
I'm smiling here and remembering during your reading at the Northwind Arts Center, in one of the essays that you read and performed, you had this line about everybody saying, oh, you're a writer, I have a book idea.
Yeah.
And do you remember it? And had to do, I think, with an analogy you made to a brain surgeon?
No, my dentist. I can read that passage for you. Would you like to?
I would love that. That would be great.
Here I was talking about being in that stage between books, and I was between the book A Woman Writing, which recently came out, and my last book, Among Friends, and I call it The Empty Nest. And I say, I read somewhere that courage is like a starfish. It regrows. And you know, that is so true for me. Most of my writing life has been spent waiting for my nerve to regenerate. And this gives me plenty of time to perfect the way I will myself, not to overreact when someone asks me what I do. And when I say I'm a writer, they tell me how much fun it would be to be a writer before they say something like, actually, I have a little book I work on now and again. I'm somewhat of a writer myself. A little book? Somewhat of a writer? Honestly, I don't understand. Really, I say, though, good for you. But what I'm thinking is how much I envy Joanne, my dentist. No one says to Joanne, you know, I do a little dentistry on the side. I'm somewhat of a dentist myself. Oh my God, would you listen to me? Obviously, I'm in a bit of a mood. Any way you slice it, this is an empty nest.
Thank you. I have remembered that because a question that sometimes is told to me if I admit or say to somebody new that I write, oh, should I have read anything that you wrote?
I don't know. How much do you read?
Right. So that's a tricky answer, isn't it? But that's a good one. How much do you read? And in my case, it's often how much instructional writing do you read about writing? And also, how much poetry do you read? Oh, poetry. I'm afraid of that.
Oh, yes.
Which,
in fact, Port Townsend's so lovely because, well, the Northwest in general, because being a poet, you're still so revered in certain circles. Now, I have to say, in some circles, there's so much tech in Seattle now that a lot of the tech workers have never even said the word poetry aloud. But, you know, in other places in the country or in the world, you can be so revered as a poet. What I love about the Northwest is that it's still revered, but only in certain circles. You go on the other side of the mountain, you know, you work in Spokane, and not so much.
Not so much. Well, we do have some good statewide stuff going on with grants and poets.
But you know how it is. It's like you have to be in those certain more creative circles, and you have to find that circle.
So speaking of that, did you start your writing as a poet?
No. In fact, the essay I brought for you tells how I started my writing career. So when you're ready for me to read
I think we're ready because that was my next question.
It's called On Becoming a Writer. It's for a collection I'm working on with that title. When I was in the third grade, I wore a mouth retainer and my words came out thick, sort of like now, how they sound after that unwise second glass of wine. Adding insult to injury, my family moved out of the city and I suddenly found myself living in a small New England town, surrounded not by the Italian kids I knew from the neighborhood, but by a swirl of Goldilocks, as my older sister liked to call them. Actually, their hair was really more brunette than blonde, but they'd already perfected the art of flinging their bangs, as if every strand was luminous as Marilyn Monroe's, and I felt too dark and too plump, and heaven forbid, my own kinky hair was black as asphalt. I sensed that if I didn't speak, I could sort of fake fitting into the suburbs, realizing for the first time that I was capable of silence and reserve, a total disconnection from everything and everyone I knew at home. Once I left school, I would run, not walk, from the bus stop to my room. Like a friend who listened without making fun of me, the likes of which I couldn't find at school. My diary let me express my confusion about adjusting to a new school, a new teacher and playmates, a new life outside the city. And like this, I wrote my way through the anxiety I felt. And so my becoming a writer began in this way, secretly. Eventually, these pages became my journal and later my notebook. But even in my teens, I wasn't thinking about becoming a writer, not that I remember. No one I knew was a writer. My parents weren't educated people. I didn't know that all the time I spent writing down my thoughts had anything to do with being a writer. I never once made that connection. What I knew was that as soon as I picked up my pen, my fears settled down. And by the time I finished talking to myself, I felt connected to a process that made me feel safe. Now, when I read one of these early entries, like when the cheerleader clique put Curl Free in my locker, or the crush I had on Steven Rannenberg that made me start off by saying, "You're going to think I'm crazy, diary, but I like that Steven." I can see how, more than anything, I was beginning to understand that life at school would get better, or it wouldn't, but either way, I'd found my voice. And today, whenever I'm asked how I began writing, I say I owe my writing life to my first diary. It was the blog of my day, except here's the thing. I wasn't writing for an audience. There was no pressure to perform. No reason to boast or pretend I was always happy. No photos to post. No selfies. I was writing for myself. To myself. This private connection is how I learned to listen to the voice inside me. This private connection is how I learned to be honest. And this private connection is how I became a writer.
Thank you, Mary Lou. And it seems that poetry maintains that private connection, although ultimately if you publish it, it's for others. But when we're writing it, it seems that we are investigating our feelings and feeling that power. Do you agree with that?
I believe that you have to completely never write for an audience. If you can share it proudly later, yes, but I try never to think about who's going to read it, because I think if you do, it's like the girls with their posting, and how I teach so many young women in dance classes, and the anxiety they feel because they're never allowed downtime. Remember when you used to go to school and you'd come home and you'd be away from the cliques and away from everyone else's thoughts about you? They don't get away from it now. It's always following them on Facebook and all the other social medias that they have in place all the time. And so I really encourage them to stop and just listen to how they feel about things and to stop posting all the time, because that's just how you feel in the moment. There's no reflection time there. You need reflection time.
So how did the poems start coming?
I think they started coming here when I was given permission. No one on the East Coast ever, guidance counselors, teachers, no one ever said, "Why don't you write poetry?" It's like, be a journalist, which I was for 10 years. I worked for Seattle Times, the PI, after I left here, because that was my only entry into being paid. It was also sort of an entry into creating a resume that, it's like I had to take a back step in order to go forward, because I needed sort of more a professional resume in order to move into the circles I'm invited to speak in now. So that's where I was led first, and what I started doing was more like journalism.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, Sheila is talking with former Port Townsend resident Mary Lou Sinelli about her poetry, essays, and work as a literary reader.
So how did the poems start bubbling up?
Well, in the Northwest, I was given permission to think that way. Nobody had ever said on the East Coast, "Why don't you be a poet?" So when I came West, I was like, wow, poets, there are poets everywhere. So I got that start here.
Right here, right in town.
Port Townsend.
Here. Do you have some poems to read to us, whether they're early ones or later ones?
Well, I do. I have one of my favorite. You know, I wrote a collection of poems, Craving Water, that's just about pretty much living in Port Townsend. And when I'm asked to do the talk, the Northwest Reading and Talk, which I'm invited to do mostly in the Northwest, of course, I always love reading this one. It's called Two Women on the Bell Tower Bench. You know the Bell Tower right on, was at Jefferson Street, right? I arrive at the Bell Tower. And they go on talking about some silly thing they did when they were girls. And one keeps saying, "Remember? Remember?" and the ferry glides serenely by, brimming with tourists gathered on a deck for a feast of seeing the way of our world. When the other woman says, "Oh, I don't know if he ever really loved me," I turn to go, because he must be her husband. But the other leans in, caresses her friend's hand, kisses it lightly, and says, "Your father did love you." And I don't know why I feel relieved, but I do. And after a pause, I walk on, and their voices follow, especially the laughter. It's so elated, so shared. It bubbles with affection, the champagne of intimacy. Because of their bond, no loneliness invades my aloneness. I bend to pick a few daffodil buds, carry them home, and later, on my sill, like close friends, they swell open and beam like candles.
Could you do another poem?
I could. I think for me personally, my most personal success in a poetry collection was Craving Water, all about living in a small town in the Northwest, and then sort of coming it from the perspective, because people out here are always saying to me, "Oh, you have so much energy. Oh, you move so fast, you know, you talk so fast," all that stuff. Because I came to a small town, and this is the only small town I've ever lived in, besides a few years when my dad actually thought he'd made enough money to, he's an Italian immigrant now, both my parents are immigrants, he'd made enough money to move us out of the city and have that big swimming pool and that big house. But as I saw it, that sort of brought our family further apart, because everybody could hide in rooms suddenly, and we weren't in a small space anymore. In Port Townsend, Larry and I lived that way. We lived on a sailboat. We still live in 400 square feet. I'm just more comfortable the way I grew up, which is in a small space, and you talk it out. You don't hide. Personally, I love Craving Water the most. When people ask me my favorite book, I will say that as far as poetry. But my most commercial success was The Immigrant's Table, mostly because I was able to create an event I could take anywhere in the country. They do the food and the wine. Not only does everyone want to be a writer, it seems like everyone wants to be Italian. And I was able to create this stage production, or small production in your living room, however you want to do it. And so it does a lot of fundraising, and it's got food and wine. And if you don't have wine these days, you can't sell it. Every event has to have wine. And it's called Veal Scallopini. On the counter, I leave pictures of calves crammed into metal cages, heads protruding, constricted between bars of steel, eyes bulging in wide balls of fear. And my mother's pity, it does well up, and it torments. But still she pounds with a blunt wooden mallet until every cutlet is tender, veins and capillaries crushed into submission. But you see, I'm 16, and I'm a reborn vegetarian, and I'm now enraged at my meat-eating family. I'm enraged at the whole beef-eating world. And I scream that her cooking is cruel, sadistic. And this is when she yells for my father, "Luigi!" The sound of his feet now is ponderous on the stairs. And I lock my door. I turn up the Motown. My father's voice shifts to reprimand, close to disgust in his eyes. I question everything my parents stand for, and they won't stand for it. And I'm unallowed to eat. I'm always sent to my room. Well, I love my room. I turn up the Motown until my bravado resigns gutlessly into tears, because even now, to this day, if I take my parents on, it comes to this: composure washed away, streaks of mascara running down my cheeks. Until about a year later, I relent, laughing at last more than crying, and now when served scallopini, veal smothered in bisque, I feast quietly on bread. Or cacciatore, tomatoes above and on either side of the chicken, I dine on bread. I'm righteous in my newly found teenage tolerance. My parents' lives, for the first time, handed to me calmly. This is my very first understanding of how I could be completely with my family, for my family, of my family, but still not only my family.
Thank you. Wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody could write powerfully of their teenage experience, that need to separate, that need to stay with our families.
Yes.
Beautiful. Thank
and
you.
And of course, I do believe everyone can write. I just sometimes feel like not everyone realizes what kind of a commitment and what kind of time that takes. People ask you, like, what inspires you? I'm like, ha, nothing inspires me. I go to work. Well, things always inspire me every day, actually. But I go to work every day for 4 to 5 hours, whether I want to or not.
That's very good. That's very disciplined.
I'm very disciplined.
I think that people do not understand about revision. They read finished work, and they just think you sit down and whatever you write is finished. And the work of it really is the layers.
The craft, the layers
of writing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's become so easy for everyone with a laptop to feel like a writer.
Oh,
used
yeah.
to go from pen on the page, maybe to a typewriter, but the whole thing slowed everything down. And now the immediacy of seeing your work put to you in more of a professional manner, face to face, it fools people into thinking it is professional. It is not.
Yeah.
It takes years of work.
I know that very many years ago I was teaching. I was the first teacher using the computer lab to teach English 101 composition at Shoreline Community College.
Yes, I remember. That's how I met you, right?
Through the college, yeah.
Yes, yes.
But not in that class. And
no, no.
Anyway, the difficulty, besides learning computing, was that people thought their work was done, even though there was a delete key, even though you could save drafts. The idea that it looked like a document really affected their writing.
Exactly.
But we have to remember that. We have to keep our drafts, but we have to keep drafting.
And also I think the immediacy, everybody turns to their phone for everything these days, and that immediacy has also fooled people into thinking that the end result should be immediate, you know, at your fingertips. And it takes years to complete good writing. Years. Just say years to young people sometimes. There's such an immediacy to the lives they're living.
Right. Very good point. Let's talk a little bit about how your training in dance and your work in dance maybe have helped you shape this career as a literary speaker and also the way you write.
Well, people ask me that all the time, and I don't unite the two that often. There's certain reviews that have come out after I've done things that say it's her dance training that allows her to give a talk like that, because as you even said before, that you read it to us and performed it, and like, I didn't feel like I'd performed it. I feel like I just read it in my way. See, that's the other thing. When I first came out here, yes, I wanted to be a poet, but when I would go to readings and everybody was reading in that same academic voice, you know, you raise your voice at the end, I just felt so stifled by that. Like, why in the creative realm do we copy what other people are doing and call that creative? And so I read in a, my mother said, you just read like an Italian talks, you know?
I was going to say.
I know. And so I just want to do it like that. And so I don't really feel like I'm performing. I'm just being me. It's just that sometimes on the West Coast, people aren't used to being around the energy level I'm used to living at.
I agree. I am a New Jersey girl raised by New York parents, and I'm married to a Michigan guy, and he thinks I'm yelling, and
we're excited. We're passionate.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And people confuse those two things all the time. They can actually think you're angry, and you'd be like, no, I'm excited. There's such a difference.
Right. Somebody called me. No, she's not yelling. She's a passionate talker.
Yay.
So that's what I say to him now.
I know. And there's an intensity about us that I think people misjudge too, because I feel like I had more street smarts at 5 than some of my friends who grew up in Port Townsend have ever had. You know, they come to see me in the city, and they're like, they see so much. I think they go home like heart affected. And I have to say, I'm able to sort of not see some of that stuff and able to cope in that world. But I love how they enlighten me into seeing again some of the, for instance, street people. If you're going to cope in the downtown in the city anywhere in this country, you have to work hard on your relationship to that. And part of it is actually compartmentalizing it. It's a struggle enough for most of us to stay up every day. You know, you don't want to sink down as soon as you leave your door. But my friends from here, they remind me to be much more compassionate and seeing.
Well, I think one of the things you see in Port Townsend is there are people who are different and challenged and perhaps almost homeless. But they become part of the fabric of our town because we see them frequently, because we get to know them a little bit. And there's something you can't do in a city.
Exactly.
Too many people. We only have a few more minutes to talk.
I know. I think I've talked too much. I'm sorry.
No, you have not. So we could do some more passionate reading.
Well, and you know, this Monday night, I'm doing, actually, it's a private event, I think. She's actually invited the Fund for Women and Girls here in town that does so much for young women. The director of that has put together an event, I think it's for all of her volunteers, which I think is so lovely. And she's having me do Among Friends because she's said they've all become really good friends. And so I'll read one poem from that.
Thank you.
And it's a book I wrote years ago that questioned the subject of friendship. So I interviewed a lot of women. It's in its third printing now. It's done well. I'm very proud of it. It's not exactly what I'd write today, but at the time I was struggling with issues, and so were all the other women I talked to. And there's some poems within the book, which I have to say, as a nonfiction book, I had to fight for. And I won, because what my editor wanted was a list at the end of each chapter of the point. And I thought, you know, my readers are smart enough to get it the first time. I don't need to bring it to attention again, a bullet list. How about if we put a poem? And I really had to fight for that. And this one is Jar of Carrots. Meg was my first college roommate. Oh, Meg, when we were young, say college age, we swam together further and further out into life, toward any rock large enough to stand on. And measuring my clumsy strokes against your grace, I felt like I came up short and envied you that spring morning when it rained until a sepia wash of earth slid right up to our door of that dilapidated farmhouse we rented together because we hated dorm life. I envied you because you had the guts to skip class, preferring to surface quietly with a mug of tea and a book. And years later, in my well-ordered kitchen, there is this shelved jar of carrots, a refusal of sorts to give up on us. They were carrots you cut up during our last visit that went sort of wrong. Awkwardness undermined our reacquainting until, though we stayed together for a week, by the second day, each of us had left for some other place. You know what? I won't eat the fruit. It bobs and floats and pickles. How long has it been, Meg? I still love you. I never said as much, but I've dropped my tough act, and I now say those words whenever I want. Odd, don't you think, how much we used to talk way into the night? But nowadays, so much goes unspoken. There are emails, but what an excuse for connection. It's like we've stored our closeness away like a tin of ornaments to bring out later in life, I hope, when we aren't so consumed by marriage and careers and our aging parents, by security, financial or otherwise, or when we just want to remember each other. I think about you, Meg. That's what I said to myself this morning. And then there was this voice, and I heard it the way a dog hears a mute whistle. I think about you too, Mary Lou. I think about you.
Thank you. It's fabulous that a prose book, Among Friends, ends each chapter with a poem, because poetry builds such intimacy, and that's the point.
I know, but it's so funny when you're dealing with editors, because they're like, but nobody reads poetry. And I was like, oh,
well, all your readers
I'm
do.
Someone.
And speaking of that, if you'd like to hear Mary Lou read again, she's going to be reading at a very prestigious venue in Seattle, Town Hall, an arts and culture series. It'll be Thursday, April 27th, 2017, which is coming up at 7:30, and I'm sure it'll be well advertised. Mary Lou, thank you so, so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, www.writingitreal.com/audio.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.